phone, but now he finds himself driving to the lake. It's still dark. While he drives, alone on the empty highway, he thinks about Cynthia. It takes a certain kind of person to blackmail another. He wonders what else she's done. He wonders if he can get something on her that's as damning as what she has on him, balance the scales. If he can't find something useful on her, maybe he can frame her in some way. He would need help with that. He recoils inwardly. Crime has not worked for him, and yet he seems to be digging himself in deeper and deeper. He holds on to the idea that he may be able to get some semblance of his life back, if Cora is returned to them unharmed, if Richard keeps his secret, if he can get something on Cynthia, one way or another, to make her back off. There's no way he can pay her and keep on paying her. He can't be in her power. But even if he can do all these things, he will never, ever have any peace of mind. He knows that. He will live for Cora and for Anne. He will make sure he gives them as happy a life as possible. He owes them that. It doesn't matter whether he is happy or not. He has forfeited any right to happiness. He parks the car in his favorite spot under the tree, facing the lake. He sits there for a few minutes inside the car, remembering the last time he was here. So much has happened since then. The last time he was here, just a few days ago, he was so sure he was going to get Cora back. If things had gone the way they were supposed to, he'd have his baby back now, and the money, and nobody would have known a thing. What a fucking mess things have turned out to be. Finally, he gets out of the car. It's cool in the early morning by the lake. The sky is beginning to brighten. The cell phone is in his pocket. He starts walking down to the beach. He's going to walk to the end of the dock and throw the cell phone into the lake, where no one will ever find it. That will be one thing off his plate. He stands at the end of the dock for some time, full of regret. Then he takes the cell phone out of his pocket. He wipes the whole thing down for fingerprints with the edge of his jacket, just in case. He was a good ball player as a teenager. He hurls the phone as hard as he can into the lake. It lands with a loud plop. Ever-growing circles radiate outward from where it landed in the water. It reminds him of when he used to throw rocks in the lake as a kid. How far away that seems now. Marco feels relieved to be rid of the phone. He turns and heads back to his car. It is quite light out now. With a start, he notices that there is another car in the lot, a car that wasn't there before. He doesn't know how long it has been there. How did he not notice the lights when it came in? Maybe the car just arrived and didn't have its headlights on. It doesn't matter, he tells himself, although his skin crawls. It doesn't matter if someone saw him throwing something into the lake in the early morning. He's too far away to be recognized. But his car is right there, with the license number in plain view. Marco is nervous now. As he gets closer, he gets a better look at the other car. It's a police car, an unmarked police car. You can always tell them by the grill on the front. Marco feels sick. Why is there a police car here, now? Was he followed? Did the police see him throw something into the lake? Marco is sweating in the cold and can feel his heart beating in his ears. He tries to walk normally to his car, keeping as far away from the police car as possible without looking like he's trying to avoid it. The window rolls down. Fuck. Everything all right? The officer asks, his head outside the window, getting a good look. Marco stops, frozen in place. He doesn't recognize the officer's face. It's not Razbeck or one of his men. For one surreal moment, Marco had expected it to be Razbeck who popped his head out the open window. "Yeah, sure. Couldn't sleep," Marco says. The officer nods, rolls up his window, and drives off. Marco gets into the car, shaking uncontrollably. It's a few minutes before he's able to drive. At breakfast, Anne and Marco don't talk much. He is pale and distant after his experience at the lake. She is fragile, missing her baby, thinking about the day before. She still doesn't believe Marco about Cynthia. Why was he coming out of her house yesterday? If he lied about this, what else has he lied about? She doesn't trust him. But they have reached an uneasy truce. They need each other. Maybe they even still care for each other, in spite of everything. I need to go back to the office this morning, Marco tells her, his voice a little unsteady. He clears his throat loudly. It's Sunday, she says. I know, but I should probably go in, get caught up on some projects that are overdue. He takes another gulp of coffee. She nods. She thinks it will do him good. He looks awful. It will take his mind off what they're dealing with, even if only for a short time. She is jealous. She doesn't have the luxury of throwing herself into work to forget, even for a moment. Everything in the house reminds her of Cora, of what they've lost. The high chair, sitting empty in the kitchen. The colorful plastic toys in the bin in the living room. The playmat she used to put Cora down on with its dangling overhead toys that the baby loved to reach for, cooing and giggling. It doesn't matter where she goes in the house, Cora is everywhere. There is no escape, no matter how temporary, for her. Marco is worried about her, she can tell. What will you do when I'm gone? He asks. She shrugs. I don't know. Maybe you should leave a message with that other doctor, the one who's filling in for Dr. Lumsden. Try to make an appointment for early in the week, Marco suggests. Okay, Anne says listlessly. But when Marco leaves, she doesn't call the doctor's office. She wanders around the house thinking about Cora. She imagines her dead, in a dumpster somewhere, crawling with maggots. She imagines her in a shallow grave in the woods, dug up and gnawed on by animals. She thinks of newspaper stories she's read about lost children. She can't get the horror out of her head. She feels queasy and panicky. She looks at herself in the mirror and her eyes are huge. Maybe it's better that she not know what happened to her baby. But she needs to know. For the rest of her life, her tortured mind will supply hideous ideas that may be worse than the truth. Maybe Cora's death was quick. Anne prays that it was. But she'll probably never know for sure. From the moment her daughter was born, Anne knew where Cora was every minute of her short life, and now she has no idea where she is. Because she is a bad mother. She is a bad, broken mother who didn't love her daughter enough. She left her alone in the house. She hit her. No wonder her daughter is gone. There is a reason for everything, and the reason her baby is gone is that Anne does not deserve her. Now Anne is not just wandering around the house, she is moving faster and faster. Her mind is racing, thoughts stumbling over one another. She feels intense guilt about her daughter. She doesn't know whether to believe Marco when he tells her that Cora was alive at 12:30. She can't believe anything he says. He's a liar. She must have hurt Cora. She must have killed her own baby. There is no other possibility that makes sense. It's a terrible possibility, a terrible burden. She must tell someone. She tried to tell Marco what she did, but he wouldn't listen. He wants to pretend it didn't happen. He wants to pretend that she's not capable of harming her own baby. She remembers the way he looked at her when she told him she hit Cora. The disbelief. He might feel different if he'd seen her slap Cora. He might feel different if he knew her history. But he doesn't know, because she has never told him. There was the incident at St. Mildred's, the one she has no memory of. She remembers only the aftermath, being in the girl's bathroom, the blood on the wall, Susan slumped on the floor as if she were dead, and everyone, Janice, Debbie, the science teacher, and the headmistress, all looking at her in horror. She'd had no idea what happened. After that, her mother had taken her to a psychiatrist who diagnosed a dissociative disorder. Anne remembers being in his office, frozen in her seat, her mother sitting anxiously by her side. Anne was terrified by the diagnosis, terrified and ashamed. "I don't understand," her mother said to the doctor. "I don't understand what you're saying." "I know," the psychiatrist said gently, "that it seems frightening, but it's not as unusual as you might think. Think of it as a coping mechanism. An imperfect one. The person disconnects from reality for a brief time." He turned to Anne. She refused to look at him. "You might feel detached from yourself, as if things are happening to someone else. You might perceive things as distorted or unreal, or you might experience a fugue state, as you did, a brief period of amnesia." Is this going to happen again? Alice asked the doctor. I don't know. Has it happened before? It had happened before, but never so shockingly. There have been times, Alice admitted tentatively, ever since she was a little girl, when she seemed to do things and not remember doing them. I thought at first she was just saying that so she wouldn't get in trouble, but then I realized she couldn't control it. She paused. But there's never been anything like this. The doctor clasped his hands and gazed at Anne intently, asking her mother, Has there been any trauma in her life? Trauma? Alice echoed. Of course not. The doctor surveyed her skeptically. Dissociative disorder is usually the result of some sort of repressed trauma. Oh, God, Alice said. The doctor raised his eyebrows at her and waited. Her father, Alice said suddenly. Her father? She watched her father die. It was horrible. She adored him. Anne's eyes were fixed firmly on the wall in front of her. She was perfectly still. How did he die? The doctor asked. I was out shopping. He was in the house playing with her. He had a massive heart attack. He must have died almost instantly. She saw it. By the time I got home, it was too late. Anne was crying and pressing numbers in the phone, but she didn't know what numbers to press. Anyway, it didn't matter. No one could have saved him. She was only 4 years old. The doctor nodded sympathetically. I see, he said. He sat quietly for a moment. Alice said, She had nightmares for a long time. I didn't let her talk about it. Maybe that was wrong. But she would get so upset, and I was trying to help. Whenever she brought it up, I tried to take her mind off it. She added, She seemed to blame herself for not knowing what to do, but it wasn't her fault. She was so young, and we were told that nothing could have saved him, even if the ambulance had been right there. That would be very difficult for any child to deal with, the doctor said. He turned to Anne, who continued to ignore him. Stress can temporarily worsen symptoms of this disorder. I suggest you see me regularly to try to deal with some of the anxiety you're feeling. Anne cried in the car all the way home. When they got there, before they went into the house, her mother hugged her and said, It's going to be all right, Anne. Anne didn't believe her. We'll tell your father that you're seeing someone for anxiety. He doesn't need to know about this other thing. He wouldn't understand. They didn't tell him about the incident at school. Anne's mother handled the meetings with the parents of the other three girls from St. Mildred's herself. Since then, there had been other episodes, mostly harmless, where Anne would lose time, minutes or sometimes hours, when she wouldn't know what had happened while she was gone. They were brought on by stress. She would find herself somewhere unexpected, have no idea how she got there, and call her mother, who would come get her. But she'd had no episodes since her first year of college. It had all happened such a long time ago. She'd thought she'd put it behind her. But of course she had immediately remembered it all after the kidnapping. What if the police found out? What if Marco found out and looked at her differently? But then the onesie had arrived, and her mother no longer looked at her as if she were afraid that Anne might have killed her own child, and that Marco had helped to cover it up. Now the police know that she attacked Susan. They think she is violent. All along, Anne has been afraid that the police would believe she was guilty, whether she was or not, but there are worse things than being wrongly accused. Anne's greatest fear now is that she is guilty. Those first few days after Cora had been taken, when Anne was so sure that she'd been taken by some stranger, those had been difficult days, having to withstand the suspicion of the police, the public, and her own mother. She and Marco had borne it because they knew they were innocent. They'd made one mistake. They'd left their baby unattended, but not abandoned. But now, because of what happened the other night before she'd fallen asleep on the sofa, she had confused the search for signs of Marco's unfaithfulness with the search for Cora. Reality had become distorted. She remembers thinking that Cynthia had stolen her child from her. The illness was back. When exactly had it returned? She thinks she knows. It came back the night of the kidnapping, after she slapped Cora. She lost time. She doesn't know what happened. It's almost a relief now, realizing that she did it. Better that Cora be killed quickly by her own mother in her own bedroom, with the familiar lambs looking on, than that she be taken by some monster and molested, tortured, terrified. Anne should call her own mother. Her mother would know what to do. But Anne doesn't want to call her mother. Her mother will try to cover it up, pretend it never happened, like Marco. They're all trying to cover up what she's done. She doesn't want that anymore. She must tell the police, and she must do it now, before anyone tries to stop her. She wants everything out in the open. She can't stand a minute more of the secrecy, the lies. She needs to know where her baby is, her final resting place. She needs to hold her one last time. She glances out her bedroom window at the street. She doesn't see any reporters out there now. She dresses quickly and calls a cab to bring her to the police station. It seems to take a long time, but finally the cab arrives. She gets into the cab quickly and settles herself in the back seat, feeling strange but determined. She needs this to end. She will tell them what happened. She killed Cora. Marco must have arranged to have her taken away and then urged them to offer ransom money afterward, to mislead the police. But now Marco will have to stop protecting her. He will have to stop lying to her. He will have to tell them where he put Cora's body, and then she will know. She must know where her baby is. She can't stand not knowing. She can't trust anyone to tell the truth unless she goes first. When she arrives at the police station, the officer behind the front desk looks at her with obvious concern. "Are you all right, ma'am?" she asks. "I'm fine," Anne says quickly. "I want to see Detective Rasbach." Her voice sounds strange to her own ears. "He's not here. It's Sunday," the officer says. "I'll see if I can get him on the phone." She has a brief conversation on the phone, puts it down, and says, "He's on his way. He'll be here in about half an hour." Anne waits impatiently, her mind in turmoil. When Rasbach appears less than half an hour later, he is casually dressed, in khaki trousers and a summer shirt. He looks very different. Anne is used to him in a suit. She finds it disorienting. "Anne," he says, looking at her closely with those eyes that miss nothing, "what can I do for you?"
"I need to talk to you," Anne says quickly.
"Where is your lawyer?" Rasbach asks. "I was informed that you would no longer talk to us without your lawyer present."
"I don't want my lawyer,"
Anne insists. "Are you sure? Maybe you should call him. I can wait." Her lawyer will just stop her from saying what she needs to say.
"No, I'm sure. I don't need a lawyer. I don't want one, and don't call my husband."
"All right, then," Rasbach says, and turns to lead her down the long hall. Anne follows him to one of the interview rooms. She starts to talk before he's even sat down. He tells her to wait. "For the record," Rasbach says to her, "please state your name, the date, and the fact that you've been advised to call your lawyer but have declined." When Anne has done so, they begin. "Why are you here today?" the detective asks her.
"I have come to confess."
28. Detective Rasbach observes Anne carefully. She is clearly agitated, wringing her hands. Her pupils look dilated, her face pale. He is unsure whether to proceed. She has waived her right to counsel on videotape, but he is not confident of her mental state, whether she is capable of properly making that decision. Still, he wants to hear what she has to say. They can always disallow the confession anyway. They probably will, but he has to hear it. He wants to know.
"I killed her," Anne says.
She is distressed, but she seems rational, not out of her mind. She knows who she is, where she is, and what she's doing. "Tell me what happened, Anne," he says, sitting across from her at the table.
"I went over to check on her at 11. Anne says. "I tried to feed her with the bottle because I'd been drinking, but she was very fussy. She wanted the breast. She wouldn't take the bottle."
She stops talking,
stares at the wall over Razbak's shoulder, as if seeing it all again as a film played on a screen behind him.
"Go on," the detective says.
So I thought, fuck it, and I put her on my breast. I felt bad about it, but she wouldn't take the bottle, and she was hungry. She was crying and wouldn't stop. She's never had any trouble taking the bottle before. She's never refused it. How was I to know she would refuse the bottle the one night I have a few glasses of wine?
Razbak waits for her to continue. He doesn't want to speak and interrupt the flow of her thoughts. She seems to be almost in a kind of trance, still staring at the wall behind him.
I didn't know what else to do, so I nursed her.
She drags her eyes from the wall and looks at him.
I lied before, when I said that I remembered changing her out of the pink onesie. I don't remember. I just told you that because I assumed that's what I did, but I don't actually remember any of it.
What do you remember? Razbak says.
I remember nursing her, and she suckled for a bit, but she didn't have a good feed, and then she started fussing again.
Anne's eyes slide to that imaginary screen again.
I held her and walked around with her for a bit, singing to her, but she just cried louder. I was crying, too.
She looks at him.
I slapped her.
Now Anne bursts into tears.
After that, I don't remember. She was wearing the pink onesie when I slapped her, I remember that, but I don't remember anything after that. I must have changed her, and changed her outfit. Maybe I dropped her, or shook her, I don't know. Maybe I held a pillow over her face to stop her from crying, like you said, but she must have died somehow.
She begins sobbing hysterically,
and when I went over at midnight, she was in her crib, but I didn't pick her up. I don't know if she was breathing then.
Razbak lets her cry. Finally, he says, Anne, if you don't remember, why do you think you killed Cora?
Because she's gone. Because I don't remember. Sometimes, when I'm under stress, my mind splits off, disconnects from reality. Then I realize that I'm missing some time, that I've done something I don't remember. It's happened before.
Tell me about it.
You know all about it. You spoke to Janice Vogel.
I want to hear your version. Tell me what happened.
I don't want to.
She takes several tissues from the box and wipes her eyes. Why not?
I don't want to talk about that.
Razbak leans back in his chair and says, Anne, I don't think you killed Cora.
Yes, you do. You said so before.
She is twisting the tissues in her hands. I don't think so anymore. If I put this idea in your head, I'm truly sorry.
I must have killed her. And Marco had someone take her away to protect me, so I wouldn't know what I'd done.
Then where is she now?
I don't know. Marco won't tell me. I've begged him, but he won't tell me. He denies it. He doesn't want me to know that I killed my own baby. He's protecting me. It must be so hard for him. I thought if I came and told you what happened, he wouldn't have to pretend anymore, and he could tell us where he put her, and I would know, and it would all be over.
She slumps in her chair, her head down. It's true that in the beginning Razbak suspected that something like this might have happened, that the mother might have snapped, killed the baby, and she and the husband covered it up. It could have happened, but not the way she tells it. Because if she'd killed the baby at 11 o'clock, or even at midnight, and Marco wasn't aware of it until 12:30, how could Derek Honig already have been waiting with a car in the lane to take the body away? No, she didn't kill the baby. It just didn't add up. Anne, are you sure that it was at 11 o'clock when you fed her and she was crying? Could it have been earlier, at 10, for instance? If that were the case, Marco might have known earlier, when he checked her at 10:30.
No, it was 11. I always do her final feeding at 11, and then she usually sleeps through till about 5 in the morning. That was the only time I was away from the party for more than 5 minutes. You can ask the others.
Yes, Marco and Cynthia agree that you were gone a long time around 11, that you didn't get back until 11:30 or thereabouts, and you checked on her again at midnight, Razbak says. Did you tell Marco you thought you might have hurt her when you got back to the party?
No, I just realized last night that I must have done it. But you see, Anne, that it's impossible, what you describe, Razbak tells her gently. How could Marco have gone over at 12:30, not knowing the baby was dead, and have someone in a car in the garage waiting to take her a couple of minutes later? Anne goes completely still. Her hands stop moving. She looks confused. There's something else he needs to tell her. It looks like the man who was murdered at the cabin, Derek Honig, is the one whose car was in your garage and who took Cora away. The tire treads are the right type, and we'll know soon if they're a match with the tracks left in your garage. We think Cora was taken to his cabin in the Catskills. Sometime later, Honig was beaten to death with a spade. Anne looks as if she's unable to take in this information. Razbak is worried about her. Can I call someone to drive you home? Where's Marco?
He's at work.
On a Sunday? She doesn't answer. Can I call your mother? A friend?
No. I'm fine. I'll get home on my own. Really, I'm fine,
Anne says. She stands up abruptly.
Please don't tell anyone I was here today,
she says. At least let me get you a cab, he insists. Just before the cab arrives, she turns to him abruptly and says,
But there would have been time between 12:30 and when we got home. If I'd killed her and he found her at 12:30 and called someone, we didn't get home till almost 1:30. He didn't want to leave. You don't know for sure that the car going down the lane at 12:35 was the one that had Cora in it. It could have been later.
Razbak says, But Marco couldn't have called anyone without our knowing it. We have all your phone records. He didn't call anyone. If Marco had anyone take the baby away, it had to have been prearranged, planned, which means you didn't kill her. Anne gives him a startled look, seems as if she's about to speak, but then the cab arrives, and she says nothing. Razbak watches her go, pitying her from the bottom of his heart. Anne returns to an empty house. She lies down on the sofa in the living room, utterly exhausted, and reviews what happened at the police station. Razbak had almost had her convinced that she couldn't have killed Cora, but he didn't know about the cell phone hidden in the wall. Marco could have called someone at 12:30. She doesn't know now why she didn't say anything about the cell phone. Maybe she didn't want Razbak to know about Marco's affair. She was too ashamed. Either that, or that the man with the cabin took her away alive sometime after Marco checked on her at 12:30. She doesn't know why Detective Razbak is so convinced that the car going down the lane at 12:35 had anything to do with it. She remembers how she used to lie here with Cora on her chest. It seems very long ago now. She would get so tired she'd need to lie down for a minute with the baby. They would snuggle together on the sofa in the quiet part of the day, like now, and sometimes they would fall asleep together. Tears slide down her cheeks. She hears sounds coming from the other side of the wall. Cynthia is home, moving around in her living room, playing music. Anne despises Cynthia. She hates everything about her, her childlessness, her air of superiority and power, her figure, her seductive clothing. She hates her for toying with her husband, for trying to destroy their life together. She doesn't know if she can ever forgive Cynthia for what she's done. She hates Cynthia all the more because they used to be such good friends. Anne hates it that Cynthia lives on the other side of the wall. She suddenly realizes that they can move. They can put the house up for sale. She and Marco are infamous here anyway. The mail still piles up each day, and the house that she loved so much is now like a crypt. She feels buried alive. They can't live here much longer, with Cynthia on the other side of the wall, within beckoning distance of Marco. What was Marco doing coming out of Cynthia's backyard yesterday anyway, looking so guilty? He vehemently denies having an affair with her, but Anne isn't stupid. She can't get the truth out of him, and she's tired of all the lies. She will confront Cynthia herself, get the truth out of her. But with Cynthia, too, how could she know what was the truth and what was a lie? Instead, she gets up and goes out the back door to the yard. She goes into the garage to get her gardening gloves. In the garage, she stops and lets her eyes adjust to the light. She can smell the familiar garage smell of oil, old wood, and musty rags. She stands there and imagines what must have happened. She is so confused by everything. If she didn't kill Cora, and Marco didn't have someone take her away, then somebody, probably the man who's now dead, stole her baby from her crib and put her in his car sometime after 12:30, while she and Marco and Cynthia and Graham were oblivious next door. She's glad he's dead. She hopes he suffered. She goes outside again and starts viciously wrenching weeds out of the lawn until her hands are blistered and her back aches. 29. Marco sits at his desk, staring out the window, seeing nothing. The door is closed. He glances down at the surface of the expensive mahogany desk, the one he chose with such care when he expanded his business and took the lease on this office. When he looks back now on the innocence and optimism of those days, he feels sickened. He gazes with bitter eyes around his office, which so perfectly conveys the image of a successful entrepreneur, the impressive desk, the view of the city and the river out the window across from it, the high-end leather chairs, the modern art. Anne helped him decorate it. She has a good eye. He remembers the fun they had doing it, shopping for the pieces, arranging everything. When they were done, he'd locked the door, popped open a bottle of champagne, and made love to his giggling wife on the floor. There was pressure on him then. He had to live up to everyone's greater expectations, Anne's, her parents', his own. Perhaps if he'd married someone else, he would have been content to work his way up, building his business more slowly with grit and talent and long hours. But he had the opportunity to make things happen faster, and he took it. He was ambitious. He had that money handed to him on a silver platter, and of course he was expected to make a success of it right away. How could he not succeed as the recipient of such a magnificent handout? There was a lot of pressure. Richard especially took a greater interest in how the business was doing since he'd bankrolled it. It had seemed too good to be true. And it was. He'd gone after the big clients before he was ready. He'd made the classic rookie mistake of growing too fast. If he hadn't married Anne... No. If he hadn't accepted the wedding gift of the house and, years later, the loan of her parents' money, they might be renting an apartment somewhere. He'd have an ugly office farther away from downtown. He wouldn't be driving an Audi, but he'd be working hard and building success on his own terms. He and Anne would be happy. Cora would be at home. But look at how it has all turned out. He is the owner of an overextended business, teetering on the edge of ruin. He is a kidnapper, a criminal, a liar, suspected by the police, in the power of an egomaniac father-in-law who knows what he's done, and a cold-hearted blackmailer who will never stop demanding money. The business is almost bankrupt, even though he's been given so much. Money for the business, connections through Richard's friends at the country club. Alice and Richard's investment in Marco's business is lost, like the $5 million they'd paid for Cora. And now Richard is negotiating with the kidnappers. They'll pay even more to get Cora back. Marco has no idea how much more. How Anne's parents must hate him. For the first time, Marco thinks about it from their point of view. He can understand their disappointment. Marco has let them all down. In the end, his business has failed spectacularly, even with all that help. Marco still believes that if he'd done it his own way, he would have been very successful, gradually. But Richard pushed him to accept contracts he couldn't deliver on, and then Marco became desperate. When things started to go wrong, really wrong, a couple of months ago, Marco had taken to having a drink at the bar on the corner before going home to Anne, where he would feel helpless in the face of her mounting depression. It was usually fairly quiet at 5 o'clock when he arrived. He'd sit at the bar, having his one drink, brooding into the amber liquid, wondering what the hell to do. Then he'd leave and go for a walk down by the river, not wanting to head home yet. He'd sit down on a bench and stare out at the water. One day, an older man came and sat down beside him. Annoyed, Marco was about to get up, feeling that his space had been invaded, but before he could leave, the man spoke to him in a friendly way. "You look a bit down," he said sympathetically. Marco was abrupt. "You could say that." "Lose a girlfriend?" the man asked. "I wish it were that simple," Marco had said. "Ah, must be business troubles then," the man said, and smiled. "They're much worse." He held out his hand. "Bruce Nealand," he offered. Marco took his hand. "Marco Conti." Marco began to look forward to running into Bruce. He found it a relief to have someone who didn't really know him, who wouldn't judge him, to tell his troubles to. He couldn't tell Anne what was really going on, with her depression and her expectation of success. He hadn't told her that things were going south, and once he'd started not telling her things were going badly, he couldn't suddenly tell her just how badly things were going. Bruce seemed to understand. He was easy to like, with a warm, open manner. He was a broker. He'd had good years, bad years. You had to be tough, ride out the bad times. "It's not always easy," Bruce said, sitting beside him in his expensive, well-cut suit. "That's for sure," Marco agreed. One day Marco had a little too much to drink at the bar. Later, down by the river, he told Bruce more than he meant to. It just slipped out, the problem with his in-laws. Bruce was a good listener. "I owe them a lot of money," Marco confessed. "They're your in-laws. They're not going to feed you to the fishes if you can't pay," Bruce said, looking out at the river. "Maybe that would be better," Marco said sourly. Marco explained the hold his wife's parents had over him, the business, the house, even trying to turn his wife against him. "I'd say they've got you by the short and curlies," Bruce said, pursing his lips. "Yep." Marco took off his jacket, slung it over the back of the bench. It was summer, and the evenings were warm. "What are you going to do?" "I don't know." "You could ask them for another loan. Tide you over till business improves," Bruce suggested. "In for a penny, in for a pound." "I don't think so." Bruce looked him in the eye. "Why not? Don't be an ass. Just ask. Get yourself out of the hole. Live to fight another day. They'll want to protect their investment anyway. At least give them the option." Marco considered. As much as he hated the idea, it made sense to come clean to Richard, to tell him the business was in trouble. He could ask him to keep it between them, not to bother Anne and Alice with it. After all, businesses failed every day. It was the economy. Things were much tougher now than when Richard started out. Of course, Richard would never see it that way. At least, he would never admit it. "Ask your father-in-law," Bruce advised. "Don't go to the bank." Marco didn't tell Bruce, but he'd already been to the bank. He'd put a mortgage on the house a few months earlier. He'd told Anne it was to help the business expand further in a high-growth time, and she hadn't questioned it. He'd made her promise not to tell her parents. He said they had their noses in too much of Marco and Anne's business already. "Maybe," Marco said. He thought about it for 2 days. He slept poorly. Finally, he decided to approach his father-in-law. It was always Richard he dealt with when it came to financial matters involving Anne's parents. Richard liked it that way. Marco screwed up his courage and called Richard and asked if they could meet for a drink. Richard seemed surprised, but he suggested the bar at the country club. Of course, he always had to be on his own fucking turf. When Marco arrived, he was nervous and downed his drink quickly. He tried to slow down when he got close to the ice cubes. Richard stared at him. "What's this about, Marco?" he asked. Marco hesitated. "The business isn't doing as well as I'd like." Richard immediately looked wary. "How bad is it?" he asked. This is what Marco hated about his father-in-law. It was all about humiliation. He couldn't let Marco save face.
He couldn't be generous.
Pretty bad, actually, Marco said. I've lost some clients. Some haven't paid. I'm having a bit of a cash flow problem at the moment.
I see, Richard said, nursing his drink. There was a long silence. He wasn't going to offer, Marco realized. He was going to make Marco ask.
Marco looked up from his drink, regarded his father-in-law's stern face.
"Could you provide me another loan to get over this tough spell?" he asked.
"We could structure it like a real loan. I want to pay interest on it this time."
Marco hadn't really considered the possibility that his father-in-law might refuse. He didn't think Richard would dare, because what would happen to his daughter then? It was mostly the groveling he'd been avoiding, this moment of having to ask for help, of being in Richard's power.
Richard looked back at him, his eyes cold.
"No," he said.
Even then, Marco misunderstood. He thought Richard was saying no to the interest.
"No, really, I want to pay interest. 100,000 would do it."
Richard leaned forward in his seat, hulking over the little table between them.
"I said no."
Marco felt the heat go up his neck, felt his face flush. He didn't say anything. He didn't believe Richard meant it.
"We're not giving you any more money, Marco," Richard said. "We won't loan you any money either. You're on your own."
He settled back in his comfortable club chair. "I know a bad investment when I see one." Marco didn't know what to say. He wasn't going to beg. When Richard made up his mind, that was it, and he'd obviously made up his mind.
"Alice and I feel the same way about this. We'd already decided to stop giving you any more handouts," Richard added.
"What about your daughter?" Marco wanted to ask, but he couldn't find his voice. Then he realized he already knew the answer. Richard would tell Anne about this. He'd tell his daughter what a poor choice she'd made in Marco. Richard and Alice had never liked him. They'd been waiting patiently for this day. They wanted Anne to leave him, to take his baby and leave him. Of course that's what they wanted. Marco couldn't let that happen. He stood up suddenly, bumping the little table between them at his knees.
"Fine," he said. "I'll manage on my own."
He turned and left the lounge, blind with rage and shame. He would tell Anne himself first, tell her what a bastard her father really was. It was late afternoon. Time for one more drink before he went home. He went over to his own bar for a quick one and then went for his walk. Bruce was already there, on the bench. That was the moment. The point at which there was no going back.
30.
"You look like shit," Bruce said as Marco sat down beside him on the bench.
Marco was numb. He'd screwed up his courage to ask, but he hadn't actually considered that Richard would say no. The business could be saved. Marco was sure of it. There were some bad debts, clients who hadn't paid, but there was some new business he was chasing. They were just being slow about making a decision. It could still all come right, with a little money to tide him over. He still had his ambition. He still believed in himself. He just needed some breathing space. He needed some cash.
"I need some money," Marco told Bruce. "Know any loan sharks?"
He was only half joking. He knew how desperate he must seem. But Bruce took him seriously. He turned sideways to look at Marco.
"No, I don't know any loan sharks. And anyway, you don't want to do that," Bruce said.
"Well, I don't know what the fuck else I can do," Marco said, running his hand through his hair, staring angrily out at the river.
"You could declare bankruptcy. Start over," Bruce said after some thought. "Lots of people do."
"I can't do that," Marco said stubbornly.
"Why not?"
Bruce asked.
"Because it would kill my wife. She's fragile right now. Post-baby, you know."
Marco leaned forward, rested his elbows on his knees, and put his face in his hands.
"You have a baby?"
Bruce said, sounding surprised.
"Yes," Marco said, glancing up. "A baby girl."
Bruce sat back and looked hard at Marco.
What?
Marco said.
Nothing,
Bruce said quickly.
No, you were going to say something, Marco said, straightening up on the bench.
Bruce was obviously turning something over in his mind.
How do your wife's parents feel about their little granddaughter?
Marco said. They dote on her. She's the only grandchild.
I know what you're getting at. They'll give her money for her education, probably settle some money on her when she's 21, but they'll tie it up in a trust so I can't get my hands on it. No help there.
There is if you're creative about it, Bruce said, cocking his head at him.
Marco stared at him.
What do you mean?
Bruce leaned in and lowered his voice. Are you willing to take a little risk?
What are you talking about?
Marco cast about to see if there was anyone who could overhear, but they were alone.
They won't give you money, but I bet they'd pay up pretty fast to get their only grandchild back.
What are you suggesting?
Marco whispered, but he knew. The two men eyed each other. If Marco hadn't already had a couple of drinks, especially the miserable one he'd shared with his father-in-law, he might have given Bruce a firm no and gone home to his wife and told her the truth, as he'd planned, declared bankruptcy and started over. They still had the house. They had each other and Cora. But Marco had also stopped at a liquor store on his way to the river. He'd brought a bottle in a paper bag with him. Now he cracked it open, offered some to his friend, and took a long gulp straight from the bottle. The alcohol blurred things a bit, made everything seem less impossible. Bruce lowered his voice.
You stage a kidnapping. Not a real kidnapping, a pretend kidnapping. No one gets hurt.
Marco stared at him. He leaned in closer and whispered,
How would that work? It wouldn't be pretend to the police.
No, but if you do it right, it's the perfect crime. Your wife's parents pay, you get the baby back, it's all over in a couple of days. Once the baby comes home, the police lose interest. Marco turned it over in his mind. The booze made it all seem a little bit less crazy.
I don't know, Marco said nervously. Do you have any better ideas?
Bruce chided him, handing him the paper bag with the open bottle. They discussed the details, hypothetically at first. He could pretend to kidnap his own child, hand her over to Bruce, who would take her up to his cabin in the Catskills for a couple of days. He had three kids of his own, grown up now, but he knew how to take care of an infant. They would each get disposable, untraceable, prepaid cell phones and communicate that way. Marco would have to hide the phone somewhere.
I'd need about 100,000, he said, looking out at the river, watching the birds circling in the sky above it.
Bruce scoffed.
Are you out of your mind?
What do you mean? Marco said.
If you're caught, the penalty is the same whether you ask for 100,000 or 100 million. At least make it worth our while. No point in doing this for peanuts.
Marco and Bruce shared the bottle back and forth as Marco considered it. Richard and Alice Dries were worth about 15 million as far as he knew. They had the money. If Marco got 1 million, he could save his business and pay off his mortgage, without any more help from Anne's parents. At least not directly. It would be sweet to take a couple million off that bastard Richard. They decided on a ransom of 2 million, split 50-50.
Not bad for 2 days' work,
Bruce assured him. Marco decided it had to be soon. If he waited longer, he would lose his nerve. He said,
Tomorrow night we're going out. There's a dinner party next door. We'll have a babysitter, but she always falls asleep on the couch with her earbuds.
You could go out for a smoke and sneak home and bring the baby out to me, Bruce said.
Marco thought about it. It could work. They discussed the plan in more detail.
Now, if he could choose the point at which he could go back and change everything, it would be the first time he met Bruce. If only he hadn't taken that walk in the spring air down to the water. If he hadn't sat on that bench. If Bruce hadn't happened by. If only he'd gotten up and left that day when Bruce sat down and not struck up an acquaintance that had, over time, grown into a friendship. How different everything would be now. He didn't think the police would be able to find anyone who could put Bruce and him together. Their meetings were rather sporadic, unpredictable. The only people around were people occasionally jogging or whizzing by on rollerblades. He hadn't worried about it before, because no one was going to see Bruce again. Bruce was ready to retire. He was going to take his million and disappear. But now Bruce is dead, and Marco is completely fucked. He needs to call Richard. That's the reason he came to the office, to get away from Anne so that he could have a private conversation with her father. He has to know what's going on with Cora, whether Richard has made new arrangements with the kidnappers. He hesitates. He can't bear the thought of any more bad news. No matter what else happens, they have to get Cora back. He has to trust that Richard can make it happen. He will deal with the rest later. He picks up the phone and enters the number for his father-in-law. It goes directly to voicemail. Fuck. He leaves a brief message. It's Marco. Call me. Let me know what's happening. He gets up and starts pacing the length of his office, like a man already locked in a cell. Anne thinks she hears her baby crying. Cora must be just waking up from her nap. She peels off her gardening gloves and goes quickly inside and washes her hands at the kitchen sink. She can hear Cora upstairs in her crib, crying for her. "Just a minute, sweetheart," she calls. "I'll be right there." She feels happy. Anne rushes upstairs to get her baby, humming a little. She goes into the nursery. Everything looks the same, but the crib is empty. She suddenly remembers, and it's like being violently swept out to sea. She collapses into the nursing chair. She's not right. She knows she's not well. She should call someone, her mother. But she doesn't. Instead, she rocks herself back and forth in the chair. She would like to blame Cynthia for all her problems, but she knows Cynthia doesn't have her baby. Cynthia has only tried to steal her husband, the husband that Anne herself is no longer even sure she wants. Some days she thinks Marco and Cynthia deserve each other. Anne hears Cynthia now on the other side of the wall, and all her hatred solidifies into a powerful rage. Because if they hadn't gone to Cynthia's that night, if Cynthia hadn't said no children, none of this would ever have happened. She would still have her baby. Anne studies herself in the shattered upstairs bathroom mirror, which they still have not replaced. She looks fractured, splintered into 100 different pieces. She hardly recognizes the person looking back at her. She washes her face, brushes her hair. She goes into the bedroom and puts on a clean shirt and new jeans. She checks. There are no reporters in front of the house. Then she walks next door and rings the doorbell. Cynthia answers, clearly surprised at finding Anne on her doorstep. "Can I come in?" Anne asks. Even for a day spent at home, Cynthia is nicely dressed, capri pants, a pretty silk blouse. Cynthia looks at her warily for a second. Then she pulls the door wide and says, "Okay." Anne steps into the house. "Do you want some coffee? I could put some on," Cynthia offers. "Graham's away. He's flying back late tomorrow night." "Sure," Anne says, following her into the kitchen. Now that she's here, she wonders how to begin. She wants to learn the truth. Should she be friendly? Accusatory? The last time she was in this house, everything was still normal. It seems like such a long time ago. Another lifetime. In the kitchen, Anne looks at the sliding glass doors that lead out to the patio and the backyard. She sees the chairs on the patio. She imagines Cynthia in Marco's lap in one of those chairs, while the dead man drives Anne's baby away. She is filled with rage, but she is careful not to show it. She has had a lot of practice feeling anger without showing it. She dissembles. Isn't that what everyone does? Everyone is faking it. All of them pretending to be something they're not. The whole world is built on lies and deceit. Cynthia is a liar, just like Anne's husband. Anne feels dizzy suddenly and sits down at the kitchen table. Cynthia gets the coffee maker started, then turns around and faces her, leaning back against the counter. From where Anne is seated, Cynthia looks taller and more long-legged than ever. Anne realizes that she's jealous, insanely jealous of Cynthia. And Cynthia knows it. Neither of them seems to want to start the conversation. It's awkward. Finally, Cynthia says, "Are they making any progress with the investigation?" She wears an expression of concern as she says this, but Anne isn't fooled. Anne looks at her and says, "I will never get my baby back." She says this calmly, as if she's talking about the weather. She feels disconnected, not rooted to anything. She realizes all at once that it was a mistake coming here. She's not strong enough to face Cynthia on her own. It was dangerous coming here. She is afraid of Cynthia. But why? What can Cynthia do to her after what's already happened? Really, with all that Anne has lost, she should feel invincible. She has nothing left to lose. Cynthia ought to be afraid of her. Then Anne understands. She is chilled to the bone. Anne is afraid of herself. She is afraid of what she might do. She needs to leave. She stands up suddenly. "I have to go," she blurts out. "What? You just got here?" Cynthia says, surprised. She looks intently at her. "Are you all right?" Anne sinks back down into the chair, puts her head between her knees. Cynthia comes over to her and squats down beside her. She rests one of her manicured hands lightly on Anne's back. Anne is afraid she might pass out. She feels as if she's going to throw up. She breathes deeply, waiting for the feeling to pass. If she waits and breathes, the sick feeling will pass. "Here, have some coffee," Cynthia offers. "The caffeine will help." Anne lifts her head and watches Cynthia pour the coffee. This woman doesn't care about her at all, but she's making her coffee, putting in cream and sugar and bringing it over to her at the kitchen table, the way she used to. Anne takes a gulp, then another. Cynthia was right. It does make her feel better. The coffee clears her head, makes her able to think. She takes another sip and puts the cup down on the table. Cynthia has sat down across from her. "How long have you been having an affair with my husband?" Anne asks. Her voice is matter-of-fact. There is a surprising neutrality to it, considering how angry she is. Anyone listening would think she didn't care. Cynthia sits farther back in her chair and folds her arms across her ample breasts. "I'm not having an affair with your husband," she says, equally cool. "Cut the bullshit," Anne says, in an oddly friendly tone. "I know all about it." Cynthia looks surprised. "What do you mean? There's nothing to know. Marco and I are not having an affair. We got a little physical on the back patio the last time you were here, but it was harmless stuff. Teenager stuff. He was drunk. We were both drunk. We got carried away. It meant nothing. It was the first and only time we've ever touched each other." "I don't know why you both deny it. I know you're having an affair," Anne persists, looking at Cynthia over the rim of her coffee cup. Cynthia looks at her across the table, holding her own cup with both hands. "I told you, and I told the police when they were here, that we were fooling around a bit outside. We were drunk, that's all it was. There's been nothing between Marco and me before or since. I haven't even seen him since the night of the kidnapping. You're imagining things, Anne." Her tone is patronizing. "Don't lie to me," Anne suddenly hisses. "I saw Marco coming out of your back door yesterday afternoon." Cynthia stiffens. "So don't lie to me and tell me you haven't seen him. And I know about the cell phone." "What cell phone?" One of Cynthia's perfectly shaped eyebrows has gone up. "Never mind," Anne says, wishing she could take this last bit back. She remembers that the cell phone might have been for someone else. It's so confusing, everything that's been happening. She can hardly keep things straight anymore. She feels as if her mind is breaking down. She was always sensitive before, but now her baby is gone, her husband is cheating on her, lying to her. Who wouldn't lose her mind in this situation? No one could blame her. No one could blame her if she did something crazy. Now Cynthia's expression changes. The false concern vanishes, and she regards Anne coldly. You want to know what's going on, Anne? Are you sure you really want to know? Anne looks back at her, confused by her change of tone.